loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, we discuss the missile strikes overnight in Syria. After Israeli strikes outside of Damascus on Tuesday, Syria hit back last night in the Golan Heights, the Syrian territory that Israel seized in the 1967 war. Then again, Israel sent another 20 missiles towards several locations in Syria. We'll discuss the quickly escalating situation and the different players involved, including Iran and Russia. And then our second segment, we talk this Thursday, as we do every Thursday, about criminal injustice. We talk about the most egregious conduct of the courts, the prosecutors, the police, and how justice is denied to so many people in the United States. Today, we focus on how to organize a prison strike and why people in prison do.
But before we get to those two stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, the state of Louisiana is set to evict about 37,000 elderly and disabled people from nursing homes after the state legislature slashed the budget for Medicaid. Rolling back the Medicaid expansion implemented under the Obama administration has been a longtime goal of the Republican Party. Notices are being mailed out starting today, and this will literally kick the elderly out onto the street. Next, a group of senators has filed a discharge petition in an effort to reinstate net neutrality regulations. The move aims to force a vote that could lead to the reversal of the FCC's decision in December to repeal net neutrality. Then, Donald Trump's decision to pull out of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action is a major setback for Iranian leaders who put their reputations and political careers on the line to negotiate the deal. Has the president doomed any liberal or internationalist bent in Iran? And then former CIA officer, peace activist, and frequent guest on this show, Ray McGovern, as well as Code Pink co-founder Medea Benjamin, were arrested yesterday for allegedly disrupting the Senate Intelligence Committee's hearings on Gina Haspel's nomination to be the CIA director. They were protesting Haspel's past history as a high-level CIA officer who was integral to the agency's torture program. And finally, Pakistan's parliament has passed a law guaranteeing basic rights for transgender citizens and outlawing discrimination in employment, a move hailed by activists as historic for the conservative South Asian country. And in other headlines, the historic talks between the U.S. and North Korea have an official time and place. They'll take place on June 12th in Singapore, a wealthy, beautiful, and politically middle ground locale. This follows the successful inter-Korean summit and several other shows of good faith, including the recent release of several American prisoners being held in North Korean prisons. Lava continues to flow in Hawaii, and a new fissure opened yesterday, 1/2 mile from a geothermal power plant. Officials moved quickly today to get tens of thousands of gallons of highly flammable chemicals out of its path. Hawaii Governor David Icke is warning that widespread evacuations may be necessary, which he also says the set of islands does not have the capacity for. He's asking for federal relief. Former Vice President Dick Cheney has waded into the debate over torture that has been reignited by the nomination of Gina Haspel as CIA director. Speaking this morning on Fox Business, Cheney said in reference to the so-called enhanced interrogation techniques implemented during the Bush administration, quote, "If it were my call, I would not discontinue those programs. I'd have them active and ready to go, and I'd go back and study them and learn," unquote. Defeated Syrian opposition fighters have completed their evacuation of several villages south of Damascus. Anti-government forces have now almost entirely been pushed out of the vicinity of the capital, leaving only a small pocket controlled by ISIS. The Syrian army's success comes the day after a wave of airstrikes conducted by Israel inside Syria. Those are today's headlines. Next up is the missile strikes in Syria. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
But first, we turn to the escalating conflict in Syria. Syria responded to Tuesday's Israel missile strikes with missiles of their own today, firing at least 20 targets in the Golan Heights. Golan Heights, of course, was territory seized by Israel from Syria in the 1967 war. Israel then attacked almost all Iranian infrastructure in Syria. Germany, France, and Russia have called on both sides to exercise restraint, But Middle East observers say this is just the beginning of what could be major hostilities between Iran and Israel and perhaps others. We're joined from Moscow by Mark Sloboda. He's an international affairs and security analyst. And in a few minutes, we'll be joined from San Francisco, from the San Francisco Bay Area, by Rick Sterling. He is an investigative journalist and a member of the Syria Solidarity Movement. Mark Sloboda, welcome back to Loud and Clear.
Hi, Brian, John. Thanks for having me. It's always an honor and a pleasure to be on.
Thank you so much. Where do you think this is going? Obviously, it seemed to me, and it seemed to John at least, obvious that when Trump was making his announcement on Tuesday leaving the JCPOA, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the Iran nuclear arms deal, at that moment, the Israeli government put its troops on high alert and told the local governments in the northern part of Israel to open up bomb shelters. And then a few hours later, struck Syria or Iranian places, Iranian troops in Syria. It seemed like a deliberate, sort of orchestrated, choreographed move by Israel and the Trump administration to escalate things in Syria. Anyway, that's what we thought. What do you think?
I agree completely. In fact, the Russian Duma member who heads up the Foreign Relations Committee specifically called out that this looks like a planned provocation that is intended to be conducted in stages up an escalatory ladder between Israel, which had previously claimed that it was attacking Syria. It's attacked Syria illegally, aggressively, over 100 times since 2011, since the conflict began. But they've been ramping it up in terms of both the frequency of attacks, the scale of the attacks, and the depth within Syria at which they're conducting the attacks. And these latest attacks occurred all over Syria, in all areas controlled by the government. And it seems that this is intended to increase a rhetorical level of escalation against Iran, right, within Syria, as if Syria doesn't have the right to choose its own allies. And of course, we all know that Syria doesn't have any sovereignty, not as far as the U.S. and Israel and its allies regard itself. But they intend to basically fight Iran, at least start the conflict in Syria. And what Netanyahu wants more than anything else is for to get the U.S. into a war with Iran. And there are plenty of neocons now in Washington, now surrounding President Trump, that want the same thing and are all too willing to play along with this.
I think that's exactly right. And I'll tell you one thing that has kind of intrigued me is the Israeli press is reporting today that every Iranian facility in Syria has been destroyed. Okay, so what's that supposed to mean? That's the end of it then? The Israelis are going to go home and the Iranians are going to go home? Of course not. It's going to be escalated. So how do the Israelis escalate it from here? Because you know they will, but not have it look like this is a war of choice for them.
Yeah, I think this latest statement is a intended as a moment of pause. The Syria has refrained from attacking back against Israel for the majority of these last 7 years in order not to fall for a provocation intended to invoke a wider war that would draw both Israel and the United States in. So they've been letting Israel attack, basically, and not fighting back, saying we'll save this for a day when we actually have our own borders secure. Then we'll deal with you. So they haven't responded to provocations until recently, as the Israeli attacks increased and increased in frequency and increased in scale. And first, Syria shot down some of the incoming Israeli missiles. Then they shot down an Israeli plane that was on the Iranian, or I'm sorry, on the Israeli-Syrian border, making attacks. Now they actually returned fire into the Israeli-occupied Syrian Golan Heights. So this is a level of escalation now from the Syrian government in kind. And after the April 9th attacks, Russia actually gave for the first time some really harsh rebukes to Israel for the attack. We haven't heard that this time. And Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was just in Moscow. He spent 10 hours with Putin. He was his guest for the Victory Day parades, celebrating the defeat of Nazi Germany in World War II. And the word, at least from Israeli military figures, is that Russia was warned of the attack beforehand, and that obviously some type of deal has been conducted. Once again, Russia did not use any of its air defenses, not even to shoot down unmanned missiles, and certainly not to target or actually fire on Israeli aircraft.
One of the things, too, that I think we ought to be cognizant of is the plan, and we see this all the time in opinion pieces, analytic pieces. The plan is for the Israelis to eventually draw in the United States, probably Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and Bahrain. We're not really seeing anything in the Gulf yet. And so far, we've not been told of the movement of naval assets. I've always been of the belief that if we were serious about making war with Iran, we would start to see carrier battle groups moving from around the world to the Eastern Mediterranean, to the Red Sea, the Persian Gulf, and the Arabian Sea. We're not seeing that yet.
Yeah, I don't think we should expect any type of imminent attack. I think this is going to be drawn out as a provocation, providing justification and so on. I think it will take months, at a minimum up to a year before they're at the level where they're ready. They've secured the domestic support in the United States. It will probably wait till after the midterm elections, because that would be, a type of uproar that they're not really looking for right now, I think, and not the type of military conflict they're looking for. And I think this will be drawn out. So I don't think there's anything imminent, right? We're not seeing any large movement of naval assets, which is always a requirement. And Saudi Arabia, of course, is still tied down in their losing invasion and occupation of the poorest country in the world, Yemen, on their borders. So I have no doubt that they would cooperate, at least provide air assets, which are significant when you realize that Saudi Arabia has been the third biggest military spender in the world for a number of years now, outpacing Russia in some years. Buying, of course, mostly U.S., U.K., and other European advanced arms. So I have no doubt that Saudi Arabia will eventually be involved, but I don't think we're looking at anything quite imminent yet. I think we've still got some months. They intend to build both the political and the rhetorical ground to provide a justification, a fig leaf for what they will or what they hope to do.
Mark Sloboda is our guest. Mark is an international affairs and security analyst in Moscow. You're listening to Loud and Clear. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, 4 to 6 p.m. at 105.5 FM and at 1390 AM in the Washington area. You can also subscribe to us as a podcast at iTunes. You can hear us at 4 to 6 p.m. at SputnikNews.com, and you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. We're talking about Syria, the escalating conflict in Syria, a pronounced escalation starting at the exact moment that Donald Trump on Tuesday was making the televised announcement that the United States was indeed leaving the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. There's a lot to talk about here. One is, what will be Europe's reaction? We started to talk a little bit about Russia's reaction, and I want to go more into that in the next few minutes. But I want to stay focused a little bit, Mark, on the scenario of what we expect to happen. We're also now joined by Rick Sterling. He's talking to us from the San Francisco Bay Area. Rick is an investigative journalist and a member of the Syria Solidarity Movement. Rick Sterling, welcome.
Hi, guys.
Thank you for joining us. What you're saying, Mark, if I got you right here, and I want to just make sure I understand, is that we're not looking necessarily at an imminent war between Israel and Iran or U.S. and Israel and Iran, but you actually believe over the course, say, of the next year, that's where this is going or likely going. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I mean, they're obviously in a conflict already, right? It was a shadow war. Now it's an open war in the proxy realm of Syria, but it hasn't yet broken out into, you know, a full-fledged direct war that would probably involve airstrikes on Iran itself and some sort of support for covert action, probably by the MEK terrorist group or so on, or, you know, the use of the CIA to generate domestic dissent of some kind. That, you know, that's the usual revolution playbook. But I think it will take time to build.
Rick Sterling, I want to ask if you agree with Mark, and what does a Israel-Iran war look like, or a U.S.-Israeli war with Iran look like?
Well, I agree with Mark that it's I don't think it's in the immediate offing here. I think in the immediate sense, Israel is intent on getting the European countries that are signatories to the Iran agreement to withdraw from that. So it's not just the U.S. withdrawing, which would allow Iran to take the decision to stay in compliance and increase the split between the U.S. and Europe. I think Israel really wants to destroy the Iran agreement and then move from there in their, you know, ongoing campaign to demonize Iran. So I can't where it's going to head. You know, clearly there is a huge risk and danger of that happening. But Israel's not going to go to war without until they're absolutely 100% sure that the U.S. is going to be right behind them.
And again, for both of you, what does war with Iran look like? I mean, in the case of Iraq, Iraq is 28 million people. Iran is 80 million people. Iraq had been already humbled, weakened, humiliated, militarily really ground down and economically ground down from 13 years of sanctions before, and had been basically disarmed before the U.S. then went in and invaded, or when Lawrence Wilkerson, Colin Powell's chief of staff, was on this show, when I asked him, why did the Bush administration invade Iraq? What's the real reason? He said it was low-hanging fruit. Well, Iran is not low-hanging fruit. I still want to sort of flesh out, what would a war with Iran look like?
Yeah, I think it would probably be an extremely extensive airstrike and bombing, including, of course, cruise missiles, you know, and other kinetic strikes all across the country at any and all nuclear sites, whether those be civilian or supposedly military, which the OPC, the Organization of Prevention Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, says there are none, but also against Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps and other armed forces across Iran, attacks on air defense, of course, command and control, political centers, and in a worst-case scenario, this would be coupled with backing of CIA covert action, attempting to stir up dissent, and open support for, you know, MEK, the terrorist group Mujahideen-e-Khalq, launching attacks within Iran itself. But I don't expect to see huge numbers of U.S., Israeli, and Saudi troops in a land invasion against Iran. That would not work to their benefit, and I think that is something that is probably well off the table.
Yeah, that's an important point, too, is the Mujahideen-e-Khalq. We should talk about them. This is a group that was established by a husband and wife team, Masoud and Miriam Rajavi, in 1965. For many, many years, they were listed not just by the State Department, but also by the European Union and the United Nations as a terrorist group. They have assassinated American officials abroad. They assassinated a brigadier general in Iran in the 1970s. They tried to kidnap the American ambassador to Iran in 1975, Douglas MacArthur II. And they have a history spanning decades of hostility to the United States. When they were finally driven out of Iran just after the revolution, they went to Iraq and were in the pay of Saddam Hussein. Well, they got smart. Masoud Rajavi disappeared in Iraq in 2003. Nobody's ever seen him again or heard from him again. But Miriam Rajavi is very, very intelligent. And what she did was she used money that the group had earned by smuggling oil across the border to Turkey to engage lobbyists in Washington, D.C. And all of a sudden, she's having her picture taken, sitting next to John Bolton, now the National Security Advisor, at a dinner reception at the head table with Rudy Giuliani. She's engaged former Democrats, former cabinet members. Tom Ridge is a recipient of MEK money, as is Michael Mukasey, the former Bush-era attorney general. And now, with John Bolton as the National Security Advisor, it looks like there's a role for the MEK, a terrorist group, now in the pay of the United States, to begin clandestine operations in Iran. That's never happened before. We don't know what that would look like.
Yes, that's happened before. Of course it's happened before. There was the Kosovo Liberation Army.
Not in the pay of the United States, it hasn't. No, when we invaded Iraq, we locked down the MEK base, and they were under house arrest. They never left that base.
They were essentially kept in deep freeze until they could be used later. I think already in the invasion of Iraq, they were already looking forward to Iran. And the reason the group wasn't disbanded or arrested or dealt with in any other way, they were basically moved from Saddam's payroll to the U.S.
I want to go to another question and staying on this again. What does war with Iran look like? And what you both of you are saying, what John Kiriakou is saying, is that there's multiple tiers, multiple layers of what a military operation would be, the employment of terrorist organizations like MEK, what you're saying, Mark, a sustained bombing campaign. But Rick Sterling, Iran won't simply be the recipient of aggression. I mean, it's a formidable country and a formidable military. It's pretty unified right now as a consequence of Trump's actions, too. Iran would strike back. I mean, how could this not end up as a regional war?
Well, right now, the war against Iran is taking place, and it's taking place in Syria. That's the focal point where the conflict is going on between the United States and its Israeli and Saudi allies versus, the forces seeking international law and state sovereignty and, following the UN Charter. So right now, whenever Israel attacks Syria, they number one say that they're retaliating and it's just against Iran. Well, it's against Syria. And then when there was a response from Syria, they claim it's from Iran. So they're using Iran as they're using the claim of a conflict with Iran when it's actually Syria that they're destabilizing. They're supporting terrorists in the south of Syria, and so in the background, of course, is Iran. But right now, there's a hot war and an increasing hot war. Israel's been striking Syria with increasing frequency, and now for the first time, Syrian forces have struck back at Israeli-occupied Golan, and that's a line in the sand that indicates that Syria, and it's not that retaliation was not from Iran; it was from Syrians.
Mark and Rick, we have just a little under 5 minutes. I want to ask you, especially Mark, but both of you. Here you have the Russian government siding with the Syrian government during the last years, engaged in military operations to make sure that the government's not overthrown, also has a strong relationship with Iran, and Iran, under the conditions of U.S. sanctions and European sanctions, will undoubtedly want to have closer relations with Russia. But yesterday, Netanyahu was there in Moscow at May 9th at the Victory Day parade, spent, as you mentioned, hours with Putin. The Russians had obviously had some level of coordination so that their forces were not directly hit by, nor would they have to hit back at Israeli targets. I mean, it seems odd. Where's Russia landing on this?
Yeah, you're looking for, black and white, block-style politics, and that's really not what you should expect from this Russian government. They have always been realist and pragmatic to the point of cynicism, and they have improved relations with Israel, since the collapse of the Soviet Union, especially under Putin. They will do business and manage relations with Israel when they can, just like they do with Turkey, which of course is also their opponent, and in a broader sense in this conflict, as they do with Saudi Arabia, Qatar, You know, and it's almost a joke in Moscow, of course, but still referring to the Americans and the, you know, Europeans.
Our partners.
As their partners. Our partners, right? It's kind of a punchline here already. But, you know, that's the type of government they are. They realize that they don't have the geopolitical horizons they once have. President Putin is well aware of the relative military limitations that Russia, military and economic limitations that Russia has. Perhaps too aware. Of course, he has evidence we don't. But Russia has basically confined itself in Syria to the position of, we will attack your proxies in order to prevent regime change wherever they pop up. But Russia has not responded, not even defensively, to any direct attacks by the U.S., by Israel, or you know, any of their partners in their coalition for regime change against Syria. And, you know, once again, Russia didn't even turn on their air defenses to shoot down unmanned incoming missiles. Now, this is done in an attempt to not give a provocation for a larger conflict. Russia is doing everything it can to avoid World War III in this situation. Of course, the irony is that by doing this, by appeasing again and again, Syrian sovereignty is increasingly being chipped away. I'm actually worried about Israel now doing in South Syria what Turkey did in North Syria, and basically carving out a border zone extended out from the Golan Heights across the Daraa area, claiming they need that to protect themselves from Hezbollah and Iranian forces that have been fighting jihadis in Syria. So Russia does have mutual defense pacts with both Syria and Iran, and it's putting its reputation as being able to stand up for its allies on the line by not directly replying back to any of the major powers behind the proxies in this conflict. I think this could be problematic. It could put Russian bases and Russian troops in Syria or elsewhere within the line of fire, because we're not seeing a drawback. We're seeing increasing escalation both from, both on Syrian sovereignty and territory itself, but also direct military attacks by both the U.S. and Israel, and Russia hasn't budged on that line. Again, not even using purely defensive air defense systems.
Yeah, I hear you on that. We have less than 1 minute, just about a minute left, Rick Sterling. Again, let's give you the final word. The same question to you. I mean, it seems that Russia is doing everything possible to avoid a larger war. But of course, as one does that, there's another price to pay. Anyway, everybody's in a corner here.
Right. And it's exactly true that, I mean, the overall trend is in favor of the forces of independence and the resistance. The election the recent election in Lebanon, Hariri and the Saudi supported groups there lost influence. Michel Aoun and the resistance allies gained in the election in Lebanon. In 2 days, we've got the election in Iraq, and it's predicted that the results will be similar to that, in favor of the resistance forces. So the trends are positive on the ground in Syria. The Syrian government keeps advancing. Now they're on the verge of completely liberating the Yarmouk district, which has been under the control of ISIS for several years. And then they'll move their focus either north or south. But they've been gaining ground. They've been removing the militants. And in the behind the scenes, Russia has been the diplomat, organizing things, organizing basically the removal of terrorists from those zones, and negotiating with Turkey and Iran. And they are the ones trying to keep the lid on the pot, which, if it does blow over, would be disastrous.
Yeah. Okay. We're going to leave it there. We're out of time. That was Rick Sterling. Rick is an investigative journalist and a member of the Syria Solidarity Movement. We were also joined from Moscow by Mark Slobode. Mark is an international affairs and security analyst. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Today we continue our weekly series, Criminal Injustice, where we talk about the most egregious conduct of our courts and prosecutors and how justice is denied to so many people in this country. We're joined from Chicago by Kevin Gastala. He's a writer for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. And we're joined from Lake Worth, Florida by Paul Wright, the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center. Paul's also the editor of Prison Legal News magazine. Welcome back.
Thank you for having us.
Hi, thanks for having us back on the show.
For our listeners who don't know, we actually send each other articles during the course of the week, so we know what interesting things we want to talk about. There's one article that was published in Prison Legal News this past week that I think is very important, and it's entitled How to Organize a Prison Strike. Prison strikes are very unusual, and they're actually illegal, but they still take place, and almost always for a very important reason. Paul, can you start us off and tell us what this is about?
Yeah, basically there's been an effort to organize prisoners and their outside supporters primarily around the issue of prison slavery, where prisoners are slaves of the state, where they are not paid anything, and also just around horrific prison conditions. And I'd say it's one thing to note that part of the reason that prison strikes are, I'm not sure if illegal is technically the term because they're not criminal offenses per se, but this goes back to prisoner status as slaves of the state. Under the 13th Amendment, where prisoners are slaves, they're forced to work, and they don't have a choice in not working. And so prison officials do everything they can to ensure that basically it's just like plantation slaves of old, the prisoners are enslaved and they're working away. And I think it's also critical to note that our entire system of mass incarceration depends on the unpaid slave labor of prisoners to function. Our nation's prisons and jails could not function without the slave labor of the prisoners that are held within them. And this isn't new. I mean, this is the same of every other, you know, system of incarceration or detention, whether it's concentration camps, slave plantations, you know, any other coercive carceral system has worked that way. So for the slaves, though, to be able to say, we're not going to work, we're not going to be exploited, really imperils the entire system of mass incarceration and prison slavery upon which it relies. And this is why, on the one hand, prison officials are deathly afraid of prison strikes. In the lexicon of prison officials, the strike is more feared, or it's on the subpar of, you know, with murders, escapes, and everything else. That's probably the most, you know, from their viewpoint, that's the thing that threatens the prison order the most, is prisoners refusing to work and be enslaved.
It's a loss of control, and it panics them. It really does. Kevin, let me ask you, when I was in prison, there was a sympathetic strike. There was a nationwide, or at least a nationwide prisoner strike had been called at FCI Loretto in Pennsylvania, where I was serving my time. There was a sympathetic strike, but it was more about food. We were getting food that was not human grade. It was animal feed, and it was clearly marked on the boxes even as animal feed. And then the kitchen, of course, was full of rats, which is not at all unusual for a prison kitchen. That's why people went on strike. You've written about that. You've written about the quality of food and the quality of medical care, which is another reason why prisoners go on strike. Talk about that.
Well, I can say what's interesting is in the past couple of weeks, we've seen a response to, I believe, this concern within prisons about the nature of the food. And I recall that the Connecticut governor was actually making overtures, he's a Democrat, about how they're going to raise the investment in prison food because it's low. It's actually much lower than Rhode Island and some of the other New England states. But still, it was going to pale in comparison to what you should invest in prison food. And it seemed like they got some of the media outlets to do a sort of like propaganda for the state government because they were talking about like the kinds of dishes they could offer. And I think they were talking about how they could improve like the tacos or something and offer a kind of food that you wouldn't expect inmates to be able to get. But it doesn't have to be just work stoppages or the fact that you're a slave. People will strike for living conditions, and that tends to happen. People will strike for the fact that there's a solitary confinement regime that they don't want to be a part, that they feel is inhumane and there's no other recourse but striking. And sometimes it'll involve hunger strikes. Sometimes they'll go so far as to not eat. And sometimes there'll be work stoppages. And as Paul was saying, it's very frightening for anybody who is running the prison. I think it's very important to emphasize that if you are a journalist and you call up a prison and you ask them about a strike going on within their facility, almost 99% of the time they're going to deny that anything is happening. And that's deliberate. That is because they want a complete blackout. They don't want any communication with the outside. They know that that's what those prisoners are depending upon. They want to be able to know that they have solidarity from people out in the public. And when they have no idea if people support them, then they start to lose interest and or willpower to continue their strikes.
Yeah, this is so important. And people don't realize that here you have millions of people in the U.S. prisons. They don't have rights. They don't have the First Amendment right. They don't have the right to speak out. They have no rights. And as a consequence, they can be abused the way a government abuses any people who don't have rights. And when you want to have a demonstration outside, when you're not in prison, you can go out and have a demonstration, draw attention to your cause. But under the conditions, the military conditions of prison life, the only way you can have a demonstration is to make it a rebellion. And as such, you're immediately confronted with all of the coercive power and the violence of the state, and it's all legal. You know, I was and thus it's extremely important to talk about this and for prisoners to have some avenue. You know, I was sitting outside of Attica Prison September 9th through the 13th. I sat there in 1971. I brought family members of prisoners who had taken D block, D yard, and of course, that ended on September 13th when Nelson Rockefeller, after acceding to the demands of the prisoners, or at least 18 of the demands, would not accede to the demand that they have amnesty, that they would not be prosecuted for having this demonstration, for bringing to the public's attention what they were fighting for. And so as a consequence, they sent in the state troopers and the National Guard, and 43 people were shot dead. Hundreds more were shot. But when you look at the demands of the Attica Manifesto, the prisoners' demands, John, they're just like what we're talking about.
Oh, yeah.
46 years later. Here's one of them, for instance. Demand number 45. We demand that better food be served to the inmates. The food is a gastronomical disaster. We also demand that drinking water be put on each table and that each inmate be allowed to take as much food as he wants and as much bread as he wants, instead of severely limited portions and limited to 4 slices of bread. Inmates wishing a pork-free diet should have one, since 85% of our diet is pork meat or pork-saturated food. I mean, that's what they were fighting. When you look at the Attica demands, and I think it's always important to not forget Attica and what the Attica brothers were fighting for. But here we are, 46 years later, same issues.
You know, my very first day in prison, Brian, was a Friday, and Friday is fish day. I've told this story before. I mentioned to a guy who was living across the hallway from me, okay, well, I like fish. And he said, no, not this fish. We call this sewer trout. And I thought, sewer trout? Okay, well, I went down to the cafeteria, got my tray when we were called, and I saw boxes stacked up right behind the serving line, and they were clearly marked feed use only, not for human consumption. And that's what we were having for lunch. And so every Friday I went hungry because I couldn't imagine eating non-human grade food. Now, Paul Wright reported something in Prison Legal News magazine while I was still incarcerated that I've referred to in my own writing. And this was a company in Texas that produced food for prisons, but it also produced dog food. And through some accident of labeling and mislabeling, they sent a shipment of dog food to the prisons, and the prisoners ate the dog food as ground beef. The shame of that isn't even that the prisoners ate the dog food. The shame is that regular prisoner food is so bad that they didn't even realize they were eating dog food. And then the prison system ended up paying a small fine that went to the treasury. It didn't go to the prisoners. and no improvements were ever made.
And I think that one of the axioms that someone once said is that, you know, every country is two missed meals away from a revolution. And I think that that's one of the things that, happens in, that happens, I think, in our nation's prisons as well. And when you look by every measurable means, I think that prison conditions today in America are as bad, or if not worse, than they were in Attica. And I think at the time, I mean, Attica is really important for one thing. It kind of ushered in the modern American era of prison reform. And, you know, and that I think was very important. But and one of the things, I forget who it was that said at the time, was, you know, Attica is every prison and every prison is Attica, because, you know, certain things were just uniform across the nation. You know, bad conditions, brutal guards, inadequate medical care. These were all the staples that were kind of manifesting themselves across the country. And today, I think, you know, the situation is as bad, if not worse. The only difference is that instead of 300,000 prisoners, which we had in 1971, we now have 2.5 million prisoners. And the other thing is that the government's got a lot better at repressing people and suppressing them. But the other thing I think that's also changed is, you know, I think that one of the reasons that prisoners were energized, in particular in 1971, was by the civil rights movement and the anti-war protests that was happening outside of society where the established order was being questioned. And today we don't have a very big civil rights movement in this country. And I think that to the extent that the prisoners are organizing around their slavery and around their conditions of confinement, I think is a huge testament, I think, to, kind of both their courage for finally starting to stand up for themselves and their rights. And these are rights as they're basic human beings, because I think it's important to note that legally in this country, they're slaves of the state. They don't have those legal rights. So just demanding those basic human rights, I think it's a huge step forward.
Yeah, that's exactly right. The Attica Rebellion happened, of course, 2 weeks after the murder of George Jackson in California, who had been a leading voice of both the prisoners movement and the Black Liberation Movement. He was a member of the Black Panther Party. His eloquent writings inspired other prisoners. Prisoners were studying constantly. I was communicating. I worked with an organization at that time called the Prisoner Solidarity Committee, and one of our representatives was in Attica at the invitation of the prisoners, along with the Young Lords Party and the Black Panther Party, and stayed in the prison until the time of the massacre. And we were writing, you know, we were getting thousands of letters every month, literally thousands of letters from prisoners, and they were all reading like leftist books, and they were reading Malcolm X, and they were studying the history of the Black Liberation Movement or the history of socialism. I mean, broad, deep research from prisoners, because as Paul is saying, what happens in the prison is an extension of what's happening outside the prison. And there was a mass movement in the 1950s, and it accelerated and became more radical in the late 1960s. And into the early 1970s. And so right before Attica, there was the Auburn prison uprising. I mean, there was prison uprisings everywhere. And I really urge our listeners to go and Google the demands of those prisoners. They're eloquently stated, they're profoundly political, and they reflect, in fact, this kind of yearning, this aspiration for a political freedom that was dominating American politics at the time. Go ahead, Kevin.
Well, I just wanted to, go back to some of these demands that you're talking about. You know, what are prisoners wanting when they go on strike? I think this is important to put out a few more of what they're demanding. The outrageous canteen prices is something that Operation Push was concerned about. This was the recent strike that happened in Florida. With many prisoners who were on strike, which the wardens did not want us to know was going, but it did happen for multiple weeks. They were upset. And just for a quick example, we're talking about soup that is normally $4 being about $17 on the inside. I'm sure John can talk about this from his experience. Other demands are things like wanting more parole incentives for people You know, usually you're seeing cutbacks to rehabilitation or educational programs. These are hugely important to prisoners. They'd rather not languish in prison. They'd rather be doing something. They'd rather be, you know, like you were talking about, studying Malcolm X or reading about something of that kind. And usually these programs are the first to go. There's also tremendous issues with the environment, which sometimes goes completely missed when we're having these conversations. But we're talking about the sort of impacts of toxic contamination from the outside with contaminated water, with things polluting. There's a group called Fight Toxic Prisons that's been doing some work and was looped in with some of the Operation Push organizers. And this is stuff that my colleague Brian Sonnenstein at Shadowproof has covered intensively in the past months. But I just think that these are important things to also be part of the when you're looking at strikes. This is part of what is going on.
You know, and it's the same is true in women's prisons. You know, there's a very popular show on Netflix, Orange is the New Black. It was first billed as a comedy. It wasn't funny. Then it was billed as a drama. There are a lot of issues, a lot of problems that are raised in this series that are truly real life problems. Now, in the last season, one of those problems was that women just do not have access to feminine hygiene products. They're just not available. Even if you have the money to buy them, they just aren't available even for purchase. And this is an ongoing problem in women's prisons all across the country. So couple that with these issues of food, of medical care, of slave labor, of an absence of First Amendment constitutional rights, and you've got a powder keg, frankly. What do they expect is going to happen? They're lucky, frankly, that these prisoners are only talking about a strike and they're not talking about a riot.
Well, you know, I'd say, John, that one of the things, though, is I'd say that all things being equal, though, that I think that the government is all geared up for riots. You know, they've got the guns, they've got the riot training and everything else. And, you know, the prisoners generally aren't armed and things like that. But, you know, what they are really vulnerable to, I think, is the prison strike. Because if prisoners have the consciousness to just say, we're going to refuse to work, we're refusing to be enslaved until these things change, I mean, I think there's very few issues in prison that can't be fixed with a work strike. Because at the end of the day, the prisons really depend on the slave labor of the prisoners. And, you know, and that's all things that that's within the prisoners' ability to control. The bigger problem, of course, is, you know, the lack of there's a lack of solidarity and unity within the prisoners, and prison officials do everything they can to divide prisoners and keep them divided, especially, you know, the way they use racism and, you know, the divide and conquer strategy is, you know, they're experts at it. And I think these are some of the challenges that prisoner organizers face. But again, we're down to, you know, just the basic living conditions, and every aspect of their existence has just literally gotten worse. And so I think it's heartening to see that we're finally seeing some organizing against that. And again, the prisoners face these enormous obstacles, repression, retaliation, and violence at the hands of prison officials.
Indeed. It's an important point that Paul is making about a strike, again, because withholding labor, which is denied the right of prisoners because they are enslaved. They are enslaved people. But nonetheless, as human beings who don't want to be treated, as the Attica brothers said, we are not beasts and we will not be treated as such. When they exercise their collective power by withholding labor, it can have an impact. Again, but that's why what organizations like Shadowproof or Prison Legal News are doing is so critically important. I mean, people should go and support those organizations because the prisoners cannot win by themselves. They need people to know what's going on. They can do a lot by a strike. I mean, remember what Johnny Cash did when he went to Folsom Prison.
That's right.
In 1968.
Good example.
And 2 years later, the Folsom prisoners went on strike. Over 2,400 prisoners organized the strike at Folsom in 1970, 2 years after that concert. They refused to leave their cells for 19 days in the face of constant hunger, discomfort, and psychological and physical intimidation. And their action was, again, about the same issues: food, overcrowding, racism. And, you know, those prisoners called Folsom and the American prisons at that time very succinct phraseology. They said, "We live in America's fascist concentration camps." I mean, that's vivid.
Yes.
Vivid imagery. And again, what happens on the outside, what Johnny Cash did or what the prisoners then did in response, and then what other prisoners did in other prisons, because there was a wave of prison organizing and prison strikes in the state of New York. And Paul, Kevin, you will know more about what actually happened. After the Attica Rebellion and after the Auburn Rebellion, and there were many other prison actions, there was a movement to have the prisoners form labor unions. And they contracted or signed up with, I think it was AFSCME or maybe one of the other public service workers. And then I think New York State declared it illegal that prisoners could never have a collective bargaining agreement. But that was the direction the prisoners were going towards, not just having, quote, a riot, but actually organizing themselves as a labor force. Go ahead, Paul or Kevin.
I think one thing that's also important to note is that the forces who are heavily unionized are the prison guards, and that but for the membership in public employee sectors, like prison guards in particular, overall union membership would have declined even more in the United States but for that. And the U.S. Supreme Court in, I think it was 1976 or 77, in a decision called Jones versus North Carolina Prisoners' Labor Union, held that prisoners did not have a legal or constitutional right to unionize, and that prison officials could legally suppress prisoner attempts at unionizing or organizing themselves. And again, I think this just goes back to, you know, prisoners' fundamental status as slaves. Just as plantation slaves of old didn't have any rights that the plantation owner or the master was bound to respect, so too do prisoner slaves today have no rights to organize or to speak collectively or to do anything about their collective status that the slave owner of today, which is the state, is bound to respect. And I think these are, these are pretty huge issues. And I think it also calls into question, I think, the whole thing about, you know, what does it mean to be a purported democracy when 1% of your population is enslaved in cages? That's their legal status. And then when you throw in another 3 or 4% of your population is under state supervision as parolees or probationers, they're extremely limited in their movements and what they can do or not do, everything from getting married to leaving the county to their transportation ability and things like that. And, you know, and again, these are portions of the population that have increased enormously just in the past, 30 years. And it doesn't really get a lot of, consideration about what the political, implications are to have this huge disenfranchised and enslaved population. And the fact that it's not even referred to as an enslaved population.
John, let's talk about, we only have 5 minutes left. Let's go to a couple of the other issues. Can you take us there?
Yeah, there's another issue of budget cuts in the Florida prison system. There were articles in the Tampa Bay newspapers, the Miami newspapers. Kevin, tell us a little bit about this. There's an $87 billion budget, but $28 million short in prison funding.
Yeah, so in order to cover a deficit, which they're probably running up because there's some kind of projects for private developers or some other cronies of the government that they're taking care of, that's usually how it works these days in state governments or even city governments, and they've got to cover it. So, of course, what's on the chopping block first? They're talking about cutting substance abuse and mental health treatment programs. They're talking about eliminating the reentry and these work release services, the sorts of things that are really, if you have an eye towards rehabilitation, if you have an eye towards even things like restorative justice, or if you have an eye towards how they're going to reintegrate into society after prison, these are important programs. Otherwise, depending on whether or not the person actually committed the crime and or not, because I know that some people in this society get caught up in wrongful claims, etc. But let's presume these people actually did the thing and they're involved in self-destructive behavior. How do you end the cycle? You need these programs to be available to people in order for them to break the cycle, especially if it's, you know, drug addiction, especially if it's some kind of violent behavior or something that relates to mental health or even just basic depression. You need these programs to be available to inmates so that they can return to society. And we want them to be able to return to society without being threats to the safety of the community. That's universally how most lawmakers and everybody else views it. And I don't think that it's wrong to acknowledge that that's an issue that we have to be concerned about. So when you are cutting these programs, when these services are what goes first, and which it has tended to happen, not just, you know, what Paula was saying, and I think it's a theme of this entire show, is what's going on in the prisons tends to mirror what's happening in the wider society. And so if mental health programs are going in prisons, they're also going on the outside. That's also what has been cut just in regular neighborhoods or communities that aren't governed by wardens. You know, that so here, instead of funding an increased pharmaceutical budget, instead of making sure that you have you know, good contractors or whatever to take care of these things, everything falls by the wayside. You see inmate health care is going to be what's going to impact inmates, that they're not going to get the kind of care that they deserve. You're going to have a contractor in for cheap who gets paid less money to not give health care to inmates.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Paul, in our last minute, these kinds of cuts that we're seeing here are not cuts that would be seen in Western European prison systems. They would just as soon cut the incarceration side of things rather than to cut reentry or job training or education or, as Kevin pointed out, mental health or drug rehabilitation services. And their recidivism rates are far lower than ours are. Go ahead and give us a comment. We've got about a minute left.
Well, first off, I'd say that to call them budget cuts is kind of a misnomer, because the budget's over $2 billion in Florida, so it's grown massively. So this is just more the shuffling, you know, this is more about shuffling money around and you know, determining where it's going. Like, they're still going to be spending more money on prisons this year than they did last year, and they're going to be spending more money next year than they are this year. So I think that's one of the things. But, yeah, one of the things, the reality, though, is that it costs money to cage people. You can't lock up 100,000 people, as the state of Florida does, and not expect it to cost money. So, and, you know, in the meantime, they're spending hundreds of millions of dollars on healthcare with a private company that kills 500 prisoners a year, which is the highest death rate through medical neglect in Florida history, and percentage-wise, the highest one in the country. So it's not a matter of, I think, of their budget and that, but it's how they're electing to spend it or not spend it.
Yeah, I think that's really what it comes down to. This is a policy decision that's made. It's not that they're in some kind of financial crisis in Florida. The money's there. It's just being spent elsewhere. And they've made a political decision to not spend it on things like rehabilitation.
Yeah, they don't care. And you know, again, I'm going in our last seconds here. I want people to go back and read the Attica Prisoners Manifesto, because they talk about this issue too, about rehabilitation. And one of their sentences very eloquently, you know, drafted, "The program which we are submitted to under the facade of rehabilitation are relative to the ancient stupidity of pouring water on a drowning man. Inasmuch as we are treated for our hostilities by our program administrators with their hostility as medication." I mean, very,
very
poetic.
Eloquent.
And speaking directly to the point, it's not about rehabilitation.
And 4 decades later, those words still ring true. Well, we're just about out of time. We were joined from Chicago by Kevin Gastala. He's a writer for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. And we were joined from Lake Worth, Florida by Paul Wright, the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center and the editor of Prison Legal News magazine. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.